Here's an All-American Big Hit, ready to rock it.
There's no sound like it sounds. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your DJ.
In the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, we used to have all kinds of strange little intros like that for our disc jockey shows. Hello, I'm Cherry Pippin, and welcome back to our second half hour of our special on the 1957 Plymouth Time Capsule. We are doing this show on the occasion of the unearthing on June 15th of the Plymouth Belvedere. It's a time capsule that was buried in downtown Tulsa, June 15th, 1957. We have some video of the event here on this page. You might want to check it out sometime. The Plymouth that was in the vault is being featured at the Tulsa Car Show all weekend. The Tulsa Car Show runs until 3 o'clock on June 17th, Father's Day. The Saturday night sock hop on the 16th is interesting. They have Fabian, Bobby V, and this group, the Chiffons. They're playing here in Tulsa and then straight to Branson for at least a month. Oldies rock and roll fans, it is indeed One Fine Day. Hey, that sounds like a song cue. Here they are, the Chiffons. The Chiffons, along with Bobby V and also Fabian, together on stage in Tulsa on Saturday night, then for the rest of June and July at Branson, Missouri. As we're producing this segment on June 15th, we just received word that Mr. Wizard Don Herbert has passed away. Mr. Wizard did his first show in 1951, by the way. He was most famous for his science-based kiddie shows in the 60s. Another guy who was famous in the 60s for being on television is our guest Mike Miller, especially in Little Rock and Tulsa. We'll get back to Tulsa and the time capsule story in a minute, Mike, but we need to find out a little bit more about how you ended up in the nation's capital on television with famous people like Connie Chung.
No, I actually took a job. There was a guy... I've always been intrigued with politics, and I'd see politicians, and I admired some of them, not very many of them, but some of them, and I knew a few of them that worked on their staffs, and I always wondered what it would be like to work for a congressman or a senator. And so there was a guy running for Congress in the 2nd District, which is Little Rock in the central part of Arkansas. Heavily Democratic area, the old Wilbur Mills seat, and it was open, an open seat, and this guy said, I want you to meet Ed Bethune. He's running for Congress there, so he needs a press guy, somebody who's good at TV, help him. So I met him, and we hit it off right away, and I had also talked to Bill Clinton, who was the Attorney General at the time, and we had drinks one night, and he wanted a number of people on his staff who with a background in radio and television. So it was obvious he was going to be the next governor. He had token opposition, but he didn't need anybody right then and there because this was in the summer. He wouldn't need anybody till January. And so I asked Clinton. I said, I got a chance to go to work for Ed Bethune, but he's a Republican. And Clinton said, well, I know Ed. He's a good guy, and he may win that race. He's sharp. And we did. We pulled it off. Mm-hmm. When I went to work for Bethune, he was 56 points behind in the polls, if you can imagine. And we pulled it off with some really wild things.
So you, Mike Miller, in political consultancy history, is kind of a miracle man. At least that helped you get another job, I imagine. You can play off of that to something else.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, an interesting thing on that race, you know, there was one thing that really won it. We were lagging toward the end of the race. Mary, my wife, was working for Bethune also at minimal wages, but it was so much fun. It was our first venture into politics, and it was very exciting. It really was. It just was unbelievably exciting. But I had, always from radio days, I always had my tape recorder with me, and I would tape Bethune when he was making a speech and lift out, you know, what they call actualities,
sure.
Feed the radio stations, and radio was very good about taking, if they didn't have to lift a finger and they got a news story out of it, they would run it.
You and I both have been in that boat. Hey, well, we'll use this. Why not?
And our opponent was a guy named Doug Brandon, who owned furniture stores in Little Rock, but he was so far out ahead of us in the polls, he didn't want to even acknowledge Ed Bethune, so he declined an invitation to debate.
Mm-hmm.
So he wouldn't debate us, but they would show up at joint appearances, and one would speak and leave, and then the other one, you know, and I'd leave my tape recorder going. And to make a long story short, I ended up with a tape recorder full of our opponent's voice, and then I started listening to them, and he was flip-flopping on issues. He was tailoring his remarks depending on
different places, different crowds.
Exactly. I mean, he'd be for something and against it somewhere else. So we ended up. He was asked that question at one of these functions after Bethune had left. I guess he was trying to get a little dig in that Bethune didn't want to stick around and answer questions. And he said, in a debate, you don't want to debate, because in a debate you would have to you'd have to explain all these issues. And if you explain enough issues, he said, I'd make you mad and you wouldn't vote for me. He slipped into the first person. He said, I'd make you mad and you wouldn't vote for me. So we ended up, I said, bingo, on the way home, back to the office. I kept playing this excerpt of our opponent saying, if I were to answer enough questions, you wouldn't vote for me. I'd make you mad, you know. And so he was, you know, trying to pontificate, but by slipping into the first person, It was devastating. We used a radio commercial on that and blew him out of the water in the last 2 weeks of the campaign.
We'll get some more politics here in a moment. Let's talk a little bit more about your days behind the scenes in broadcasting. When you went to Washington, you worked with a lot of people. Bob Cheaper, CBS, Connie Chung. Yeah, Connie Chung and you had a thing going, kind of.
Well,
she liked you.
In my dream. Connie, we were at Channel 5, WTTG in Washington, is the independent station owned by Metro Media. And they had quite a good news staff of people. Bob Schieffer and I went to work there the same day. And Connie walked in one day looking for her first job. She's fresh out of the University of Maryland. You could imagine what she looked like. She was just a knockout, you know, as a young woman. And she's still pretty attractive. But she walked in, and the news director, Mike Buchanan, stood up and he said, "I don't know who you are or what you can do, but you're hired."
Now Buchanan was a real character, kind of Luke Grant type, but probably worse than that.
He was insane. He came from Oklahoma City, Channel 9.
Uh-huh, that explains it.
That probably has something to do with it. But every afternoon, he would organize a hockey game in the newsroom. It was carpeted. And there was a golf bag in there, and everybody got golf balls out, and we would play hockey with the golf balls and the golf sticks. And, I mean, it got pretty furious. It was, people would be trying to type, and a golf ball would whiz by their head. And so after a few minor injuries, we switched to a film can, the core, you know, the little plastic core in the middle of the film, and at least people weren't taken to the hospital. But the big boss came through one day in the middle of the hockey game showing off the station to some clients, and he really gave us a dirty look. I don't know how he explained that. But he would also, he loved to do practical jokes. He would jump out of a car. When he was a reporter, he was with the station before he became news director. The cameraman told me that they would be driving down K Street, and all of a sudden Mike would jump out of the car, run into a building.
Heavy traffic, I bet he beat them out of the building by the time they got down.
Walk away, they'd see Mike, you know, thumbing a ride.
Yeah.
He would run down the
hill. Well, that's probably, as you found later when you were a news director, that's probably a good release. You probably need something like that.
Oh, it kept everybody real loose. And in fact, when I became a news director after that, I tried to emulate Mike Buchanan, not to that extreme, but the ways that he always kept the staff relaxed.
We're going to get back to the Tulsa TV scene in the 50s and 60s with Mike Miller. We're broadcasting from Shadowwood Mall. You probably can hear the people moving around in the background. Muskogee's just south of Tulsa. We're in a bedroom community. Oh, the chamber hates to hear things like that. We'll be back. Don't go away.
Hello, this is Farah Hürdüzü. Maybe you have questions about love, your job, your health, money and more. With my psychic gifts and my tarot readings, we can reveal the solutions to your deepest mysteries. Please visit me through Jerry Pippin Radio and let's find the answers together.
Click on Farah's banner for the answers to the most personal question.
Take good care of my baby. Now don't you ever make her cry. Just let your love surround her. Paint a rainbow all around her.
In honor of the 50-year-old Tulsa time capsule being opened in downtown Tulsa, Bobby V, Fabian, and the Chiffons are appearing in an old-fashioned sock hop on Saturday night.
He's a soft-spoken guy. Also seems kind of shy. Makes me wonder if I should even give him a try. But then again, he gets shy. He gets shy away forever. And I'm gonna make him mine. If it takes
Friday night, they opened up the Belvedere, and guess what? When they unwrapped the plastic, it was full of water. Rusted, 50-year-old water. But I think they salvaged some things. We'll talk about that later in the show. Right now, let's talk to Mike Miller again, and let's talk about 60s television. And in Tulsa, and even in Little Rock, really, because I think they were from there originally, the Pitcock brothers were pretty popular.
Bob Gregory, who's Bob Pitcock, is his real name, but he gave me my first job in radio at KTUL Radio. And I walked in and I saw him, met him for the first time. I thought, this guy looks a little bit like Gregory Peck.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't surprise me that his on-air name was Bob Gregory. Yeah. He had the deepest voice.
Yes, he did.
I have ever heard in my life.
Now, you became very good friends with Gregory. Gregory was responsible for you coming back to Tulsa.
Yes, yeah. When I was at Channel 5 in about the second year, the unions went on strike, and I had a lot of bad experiences with the unions clashing. We had a non-strike clause in our union contract, so we couldn't honor the picket lines, and there was a lot of resentment. So he called, and he said, how would you like to come back to Channel, or come to Tulsa at Channel 8 and be news director? He was vice president of news, and Jimmy Lake had talked him into leaving CBS News, and where he had been working, and coming there as vice president of news and doing these specials. He did a series, Oil in Oklahoma and the Five Civilized Tribes, and was doing just monthly specials. Bob was a little eccentric, and we used to call him Alistair Cook. You remember Alistair Cook was doing those same kind of specials at the time? But he became a great friend, and
you went to his wedding.
I was in his wedding, got drunk.
And then went down to Channel 2 and did the news.
Yeah, I looked in the mirror about 4 o'clock. I said, God, I've got to do the news, and I'm drunk. And I've been drinking champagne, and I don't know if you've ever gotten drunk on champagne, but it can creep up on you pretty quick. And that was horrible. I had to go home, drive back to the station and put together a whole newscast. And those were in my drinking days. I quit drinking.
Well, in fact, that's one of the good things about this book, I think, is you delve into not only these incidents, but you also talk about your bouts with the problem of drinking.
That's right. And, drinking was so much a part of radio and television in the late 50s and 60s.
It certainly was. And you talk about every night when you got off the air, you go drink, and what would you do? You'd listen to tapes.
Yeah. We had a club. When I started out at KTO Radio, I was a night DJ, but did the news too, you know, rip and read and all that, and make calls. Check.
Great stories in there, by the way, Mike, about the rip and read days. I could identify with AP and UPI, and they'd have the mistakes. And you tell a story about a guy on Mutual Broadcasting reading the same article, and there was a screw up in the.
I didn't realize. I knew we ripped it and read it cold, but I didn't realize the networks were doing it too. This is early Sunday morning, and I would monitor the Mutual Radio Network for actualities that I could lift out, President Eisenhower or whoever was president at the time, and lifting. He's reading the same words verbatim, and I look ahead a little bit, and it's all garbled. And I said, well, I hope he's not just reading this cold, but he reached that and just stumbled all over the place. Couldn't figure out what to say next, and I thought to myself, geez, preparation is a good thing.
Yeah. Now, back to the four disc jockeys on the air in Tulsa at the same time, at night.
Yeah, formed a club, a drinking club, all of the night disc jockeys. When we signed off, we would go down to KRMG. Larry Strain was the disc jockey there.
Yeah, he's an Arkansas guy. You know, he's an Hot Spring.
Yeah, great guy. A great voice.
And yes, he was. He used to do that music till midnight.
Yeah, and he was kind of one of the ones that got me into broadcasting. I loved to listen to him. Anyway, we would all go down there and get in the main studio. There'd be maybe five or six disc jockeys and their friends, hangers-on. I mean, Jim Hartz had come down there and a few others. And we would record, get the recorder, just hit the record button and sit in there and drink and tell jokes and just have a ball. And then after about an hour, we'd play back the recording to see how stupid we sounded. A crowning achievement, Jerry, was one night we decided on all the stations at precisely the same time to play this terrible record.
You don't remember the name of the song?
I don't remember. It was so forgettable.
Okay.
It was a kind of record. That
was the first assignment I told Roberta, who you met, produces a show. I said, find that song. She said, well, he doesn't name it.
I wish I could remember the song, but it was just, every week or two, you'd get all these new records coming out, and 45s, I think, And it was just the worst thing. Horrible.
Oh,
and we all agreed immediately, let's all play that at the same time on all the stations. And so we thought that'd be neat. Somebody driving down the street, switching stations. And, you know, you wouldn't want to listen to that song very long, so you'd switch stations,
and it's there again, and there's another
one.
We're talking about back in the days when 4 or 5 a.m. signals were about all you could get.
That's right, before the FM got really popular. I think they had KWGS out at the University of Tulsa, and that was about it.
And so the people were held captive in their cars. And I can see them hitting you, KRMG, KAKC, KTUL.
K-O-M-E. And I was listening to KAKC, so I wanted to make sure I started my record precisely when KAKC started his, and he was listening to another station.
No, it was Scooter Seagraves.
Scooter Seagraves, who's a legend, I guess. He not only started the record, but after about 10 seconds, he said, this record is gaining in popularity. Switch around. You'll hear it on almost any station.
That sounds like Scooter.
Yeah, so he was encouraging people to do that. I imagine there were a few cars that may have left the highway.
It's interesting. It was competitive back in those days, but most of us were friends with everyone.
Everybody, yeah. Really. You go on, even in TV later, you'd go out on a story, and maybe your competition had a camera malfunction or they ran out of film, and you'd shoot it for them, or they'd shoot it for you if you were in trouble.
Now you have an interesting story about your days in Washington, D.C., where the union guys stood in front of your camera. You couldn't get the film, and somehow you made the competition give you the film.
That's right. There was a hijacking of a jetliner out of Dulles Airport, and the station was on strike, so we had to shoot our own film. Our camera crews, sound men, electrician, were all on strike. So a producer and I jumped in a car and drove out to Dulles, and we couldn't see the plane. It was parked at one end of the runway, so we climbed over the fence and made our way to the runway. And after about 15 minutes of going through the woods, we instead of the runway, there's our car. We had walked around in a big circle, not realizing it. So we took right angles, and the next time, in about another 10 minutes, there's the runway, and the plane is taking off as we approach the runway. And it's just maybe 100 feet in front of us. It's spectacular footage. I shot it, this plane lifting off. And that night, the pilot and the FBI had a big news conference out at Dulles, and we were all set up shooting it. And the different network photographers or soundmen would take turns standing in front of our lens, blocking our view.
Because you guys were strike breaks.
Because we were, and then one of my best friends who had worked with me at Channel 5 had gone over to CBS, a guy named Bob Peterson, later shot for 60 Minutes, terrific photographer. He cut our cable. He just got out some scissors and cut our power cord just to the camera, so we were powerless. And it was very disappointing to go back to the station with no story. The first time in my life it had ever happened. Mike Buchanan, the news director, was furious. And he called CBS News and complained about it, and they actually apologized, sent us Bob Peterson's own film. So we used the film of the guy who cut our cable.
I'm surprised you had enough nerve to try to shoot another airplane incident with your camera, because that was your first assignment, I think, in television.
Oh, that was an interesting story. The news director was a guy named Austin Schneider, and he was a very big, big, heavyset guy. And he had a terrible temper, which I found out on the very first day when I had just arrived at the station. I didn't know anything about shooting film. I'd just been in radio. Right. And I mean, all of a sudden now I had to learn how to shoot film and wear makeup and all that stuff. Television was all new to me, and so there was a plane crash out at the airport. A plane had belly landed, and Austin gave me a Bell and Howell camera. It was a little, they're they're very rugged cameras. And he said, set it on, I don't know, 11, F11 or something. And he said, is this wide angle? Everything should be in focus. Go out and shoot it. So I went out there and I shot it, and it came back, and the film was beautifully exposed. I thought, terrific. And he took it and just threw it across the room and kicked a desk drawer and just shattered. And he didn't like my film because it happened to be upside down. No one had shown me the top from the bottom. And so it was beautifully exposed, but it was upside down, so it wasn't usable. And I thought that was being a little tacky.
Yeah, right. But evidently you rose on up the ladder there at Channel 2.
It was a good place to learn. Yeah, a good place to learn because...
You had to do everything.
Had to do everything. Had to process your own film, and that was kind of interesting because it would it was a huge machine, and... Sometimes the film, once it got processed, would go through what they call a dry box, and where it was heated and all that. And it would break sometimes in there. And when it broke, you were really in trouble. I mean, especially if the newscast was within 20 minutes. And all that, things you have to do before it gets on the air. And, you know, sometimes we would run down the halls of Channel 2 with this long trailing edge.
Yeah, the projectors, the film chains, if I remember back in those days, I worked in TV too. They were usually far away from the control room for some reason. I guess because of the noise.
It could have been. Yeah, you're right. They weren't right there close by. But we'd just try to dry it quickly. Sometimes we'd run with it, and Harold Stewart, the owner of the station, would bring... Like the guy up in Channel 5, he'd be bringing clients through, and there's some of his personnel running down the hallway with film trailing behind them, you know, half a...
You mentioned Harold Stewart, made his money in the oil business. You talk about Jimmy Lake, made his money with Griffin Grocery Company. And it really kind of ties in like the early icons in Las Vegas, because... In today's corporate world, I don't think you see the CEO running down the halls of the TV stations, talking to the newsmen, kibitzing with the salespeople. But back in those days, they were kind of hands-on.
Pretty close. I know in the case of Channel 8 and Jimmy Lake, he, of course, lived in Muskogee, and he watched Channel 8 like a hawk.
Taping the show in Muskogee today. Right. And I think he probably even called you down to some meetings at his office. I don't know.
Yeah, a few times. The embarrassing thing that ever happened to me, I was anchoring the news, and, of course, he had his annual antique show.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing.
Big, of course.
And we always nicknamed Jimmy Lake the Chief. He was the Chief.
Mm-hmm. And he liked it.
And he liked it.
Yeah, right.
We didn't call him the Chief too much to his face, but we did. And in fact, we had little bumpers into the commercials, a little bumper card promoting the next story that's coming up. And, of course, we'd get memos from time to time from Jimmy Lake suggesting maybe we'd like to cover something from one of his friends or a client or something. I remember one time when I was news director, we designed one. It just said, for the Chief. but this night I was anchoring the news, and we had saved the last 4 minutes of the newscast to give this great in-depth story on his antique auto show out at the fairgrounds. And during the commercial, I promoted it, you know, we'll be back with the big antique auto show. And about that time, the director calls down on the intercom and he says, Mike, we can't find the film for that story.
Oh.
And I said, what? No, you're kidding. Lake had retired after the show with all his buddies, had gone to his house to watch.
Waiting to see
of course
them.
They're going to watch Channel 8.
Right, right.
And here I have to come back and say, there wasn't time, you know, to launch a search party, and I had to apologize at technical difficulties, of course, prevented us from presenting this, and that was very embarrassing. And two people got fired: the photographer who edited the piece but forgot to bring it up to the projectionist, and the projectionist who never bothered to ask for it. were both there in the unemployment line the next day.
Well, we'll be back in a moment with Mike Miller. In the next half hour, we're going to have an Elvis story. You can't do something about the 50s and 60s without an Elvis story. In the background, Nelson Riddle and Liz Vaughn Antigua. Not all the music in the 50s and 60s was rock and roll. This is Jerry Pippin, and this is our special on the Tulsa Time Machine. It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Files on JerryPippin.com.
It looks like it's about 8 or 10 miles west.